You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Michael McMillan is an illusionist, a conjurer of neo-fictional narratives. He's a trickster. He's an explorer. He's an L.A. native. He was born and raised here and received both his M.A. and M.F.A. degrees at UCLA. He's had one-person museum exhibitions at LACMA and the Whitney Museum of American Art, among others, and he's been presented in group shows at the Guggenheim and the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., among others. Currently on display at the Oakland Museum, and perhaps some of you, have any of you seen the show, Michael's show up in Oakland? It's a beautiful, beautiful exhibit. It's on until August 14th. Michael C. McMillan, Train of Thought. It's an exhibition spanning the 40-year career of this internationally renowned Southern California mixed media artist, and it features the large-scale multi-sensory installations, assemblages, sculptures, paintings, drawings, and films that invite viewers into a made-up world, a skill for which McMillan is best known. I did get to go to one of the installations up there, and when you enter Michael's installation, Pavilion of Rain, first you cross a wooden footbridge, across a moat, into a corrugated metal shack, and there's a musty, humid smell. It's a kind of smell that brings back memories you probably never had. There's scavenged junk lying around. There's old metal signs. There's dinged up containers. There's all manner of old things that might still find new uses. And it's sort of like a visit to Michael's studio in Santa Monica, or even a visit inside his head. Periodically, rain drums down on the shack, and it treats the visitor to a sort of percussion orchestra. It's a meditative space. It's friendly and ominous. It's welcoming, and it's also very lonely. It's a very beautiful installation. As LA Times art critic Christopher Knight wrote, McMillan, born in Los Angeles in 1946, was a baby boomer in the land of post-war American sunshine. The melancholic tension between dream and reality, cheery optimism, and unforgiving decay reverberates through his compelling 40-year retrospective. Intimations of personal, social, and cultural mortality merge. The show, he says, is an elegy for a ruined landscape, leavened by a bittersweet, brain-twisting humor. And the exhibition at the Oakland Museum of Art is accompanied by a fully illustrated catalog, and I want to thank L.A. Louver, who've been so wonderful to work with on this program, for making it available for sale tonight with a discount to Library Foundation members and for helping us organize the evening. I also want to thank distinguished art curator Howard N. Fox for agreeing to join us tonight as interlocutor. Howard is an independent curator and art writer. He served as curator of contemporary art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art from 1985 through 2008, where he produced many exhibitions and their catalogs, among them Robert Longo, A Primal Spirit, 10 Contemporary Japanese Sculptors, Larry Pittman, and The Eleanor Anton Show. Now we will journey to Cannibal Island for an evening of short films, curious images, and free conundrums. Please welcome Michael C. McMillan and Howard N. Fox.
Good evening, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Michael. We've been looking forward to this for a long, long time, quite some months now that the program was planned, and we've been chatting over the last week about some topics that we hope to suss out this evening. And before we begin, we should just say a word or two about your show up in Oakland that we just heard about.
It's 40 years of experiments, basically. Beyond that, I don't know what to say. It's you have to be there. As with most good things, you can't describe it adequately. It's better to experience it, as will become evident, I think, with some of the images that we'll see tonight.
Well, Louise did give us a little taste of the kind of magic and the mystery that one experiences walking into Michael's environments. Before we do begin tonight's program proper, just talk about the experience for you. How does it feel emotionally? To have the opportunity to go and look at 40 years of your work that probably is not accessible to you between then and now.
No, the nature of the work, large installations only exist for a brief period of time. Because of their nature, they're large objects that take space and time, and it's rare to be able to see them all at one time. And the show is not all of them, it's a selected grouping. Sure. So it was like seeing old friends. I had old ideas I hadn't thought about for many years. It was kind of scary, but I'm glad I did it.
And when you bring all of that complicated art and artifact out of storage, did it represent itself to you? Did it represent itself to you as with the same reality that you had, that you remembered?
It was like reading a book again after years of not reading it. I remember the initial ideas and impulses that took me to that place, and I could relive all the work involved in building these things. But looking at them now with the perspective of time, it was different. Not worse, not better, just different.
And speaking of reading a book, why don't you show us this, and then we will begin our formal presentation.
Okay.
Our informal but scheduled presentation.
This is the exhibition catalog for the exhibition at the Oakland Museum, the retrospective. Long after the museum has closed the show and the pieces are all disassembled and go back to being piles of junk in my backyard, the book will exist, hopefully, as a record of the experiments that occurred a long time ago.
And remember, Michael will be here signing these for members of the Library Foundation. We thought we would begin with a little bit of a film festival for you. In recent years, Michael has been working to create a series of films. These are complete features with a beginning, a middle, and an end, sort of. But I think the longest of them is maybe a minute and a half. Well, one of them is about 3.5 minutes.
Well, the ones tonight are short. I have made longer ones, but these are mercifully short. So you don't have to run for the exits.
Well, we'll show a couple of those right now. And Michael and I are going to have to turn our backs to you, but that's so that we can join you in observing the films. Roll them.
Okay. This is a photograph taken in 1975 at the Art Institute.
Well, before we go back and talk about that, let's just talk a little about these the films that we just saw for a few minutes.
Okay.
And I think that will be a kind of nice transition into what else you have in store for us. Yes, thank you. Your art, even the non-cinematic art, is highly, highly influenced by movies. And I think it's pretty well known. If people are here tonight, they probably, some of you must know that Michael has a personal and family background in the movie business. Tell us about that a bit.
Well, when I got out of art school in the early 70s, there were not a lot of jobs around for artists. It still aren't.
Unlike today.
Unlike today. So I kind of fell into working in the movies as a prop maker based upon skills I had as a sculptor. And I found that it was a very interesting way of making a living. I was able to learn additional skills from other craftsmen. And I really enjoyed the communal aspect of the work. Teamwork versus the solitary studio work the artist has often.
And what kind of studio work were you doing as you left school and had to find a way to support yourself by making, you specialized, I gather, in miniatures?
That's what I was hired to do.
Yeah. What was your work like early on, and then how did it begin to meld with your work in the movies?
Well, I was building miniatures, actually, when I was in art school, because I didn't have funding to build large installations. So I was experimenting one day with those door security viewers. You peep through to see the bad guy outside, and realized that this is kind of trippy stuff, and it kind of distorts perspective. And I was playing with some small objects and realized that you really couldn't tell how big they were if you looked at them properly, and started making these miniature rooms, interiors, that I would then install behind a locked door, and the viewer would come up and look at it, and if you did it the right way, they couldn't tell if it was full scale or a miniature.
But now, were you making such little tiny environments in art school, or?
Yes.
You were, as far back then?
Before the film work.
Before the film work. And obviously, making miniatures and making objects that don't exist in nature, but that look like very convincing representations of them in a cinematic context, this obviously fed into your work later on. And you didn't mention, but your father was also involved in scenic design. And
yes, my father came out to California to try to get into the movies as an actor, but I never quite got the breaks. But ended up working in the television, in the then young television business in Los Angeles, and eventually became head of scenic art at Metromedia when they still existed. Uh-huh. And so I remember growing up, basically, I'd spent a lot of time at the studios watching him make these paint sets and make this illusion that at home looked very convincing, but in reality looked very strange and forced.
Yeah, you would see these things not just from the front as a theatrical or a television audience would. You knew the support systems in the back and the hokum that really goes into all kinds of theatrical scenic design. I guess that brings us up to this juncture in your career. Tell us what we're looking at.
What we're seeing now is the exterior facade of my first installation done out of school. It was the Traveling Mystery Museum. This was shown at the Art Institute of San Francisco. And in the gallery, we constructed this box-like room and painted the outside to look like a really run-down kind of roadside attraction place. The piece was originally shown in Venice, California, in a similar situation. And the idea behind the work was to create a series of outrageous displays that couldn't possibly exist, but presented in a way that maybe they could. So each piece in the exhibition looked credible to a degree, but if you read the fine print and the captions, you realize they had nothing to do with the object they purported to explain. So the whole thing was really a study about illusionism and camouflage and how people tend to see what they want to see as opposed to what they really see. So it was a study in observation.
And this dates from when?
It was done in 1973.
1973.
And was shown in, here was 75.
Okay. At that period in recent American art, while there was a lot of early conceptual art going on, and pop art was certainly, had been around, the prevailing mode, certainly the one that captivated and almost monopolized critical attention, was a minimalist strain, where artists were working with industrial materials like Corten steel or concrete, cast concrete or aluminum, and making huge, not always huge, but somebody like Richard Serra certainly favored, or Donald Judd favored, large-scale objects that were made out of these very basic materials that were uncompromisingly, obdurately literal about what they were made out of. What Frank Stella very famously said about his own art. He was not a minimalist, but he said at about the same time, when it comes to my art, what you see is what you see. In other words, it was a complete manifestation. There was no tricks. There was no illusion. There was no bending of materials to disguise them as something else. And here you come along, and you're working with imagination, make-believe, storytelling, blatant fiction. How did you see yourself in relation to what everybody else was talking about critically?
Well, I obviously I didn't. I mean, I
good.
I dabbled. Let's say I dabbled in that medium in art school and found it didn't satisfy what I needed in the experience. It just didn't. It wasn't enough for me, and so I didn't follow that route at all. I discovered the works of Ed Keenholz and H.C. Westerman, people like that, that really I found very interesting and unusual.
And their choice, your choice of materials generally consisted of?
A lot of found materials. It was, as a young artist, it was available economically. It was basically free. A lot of it was cast-offs of the culture, junk, basically. But each piece seemed to have some kind of a inner story that could be then integrated into something else. So I've always been attracted to them. It goes back to when I was a little kid, finding, you know, growing up in L.A. in the 50s, it was all this wonderful discards from, you know, that part of the century, 20th century. So I'd drag home wagons full of parts and things, and old radios and TVs, and take them apart and try to make something out of them as a kid. It was a childish impulse that I still have.
I think it's a very artistic impulse. Is that you standing there?
I'm afraid so, yes. That was when I had hair.
Well, you still do. You just shave it.
Yeah, I choose not to have it. Yeah.
What was the response to this piece?
It was good. When I first showed it in Venice, I was there for about a week. I treated it like a performance work where I became the carny at the door taking the 10-cent admission. And I even had a souvenir stand with postcards and other things like that inside it. So it really, I wanted to as much as possible, blur the line between art and life. And that's why I chose not to show it at the UCLA gallery, but took a storefront instead, so that it had no association with art. I wanted people to come to it and have an authentic, untainted experience.
The fact that you have utilized the image or the concept of a museum in this piece, and then kind of totally subverted what that museum is. It's not showing art or real artifacts. It's showing made-up things that don't really exist in the real world. And then avoiding showing it in a fine art context by declining to show it at UCLA. I guess that was the White Art Gallery at that time. And where in Venice did you show it? Just the storefront?
It was on 14 Westminster Avenue.
Oh, that's what I thought.
Yeah. A friend of mine, it was his studio, and he was going, I think, up to Alaska for the summer. And so he sublet the studio to me for about a month. So I set up the museum and ran it for a few weeks.
So you're kind of steeping yourself in a almost in an anti-culture. You're coming out of a rigorous academic background at one of the finer art schools in the country, but you're being something of not a rebel, but a willful misfit.
Yes.
What happens next?
Well, the next line?
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, okay. Actually, there's a few artifacts from this in the show in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
But the main attraction was the mystery mummy. It was a honey. This is a piece from 1978. called Inner City. This was, it started out as a, the building in the foreground is an individual piece called The Artist Studio. At the time, I didn't have a studio. I had to work in a bedroom. It was kind of dusty and crowded. And then I moved to a garage, a small garage. But and all my friends had these nice studios. And so I said, well, I want a studio too. So I built my own studio, and that's it. It was my fantasy studio. But from that piece was shown at the old Newport Harbor Art Museum by Betty Turnbull in a show called Sounds, Installations by Four Artists. It was Michael Brewster, Eric Orr, Carl Chang, and myself. We all did works that had sound as a thematic thread. As you walk by this piece at eye level, you can hear people having a conversation inside the rooms. There's noises of construction in the back of the building. So that was the first piece that grew into Inner City. And the additional four buildings were made after that initially, and this was shown at LACMA in 1978 and then the following year at the Whitney.
That was the time that I first encountered your work. I was a curator at the, then an assistant curator at the Hirshhorn Museum, part of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and I was in New York, and I went to the Whitney, and I had never seen anything like this, not in an art museum. And I really applauded that the Whitney, you know, which was itself a brutalist piece of architecture, and remains such, not a very user-friendly place, though an impressive piece of architecture nonetheless. But I encountered this, and I think it really opened my mind curatorially to a range of possibilities that just it certainly was not very well represented in the Hirshhorn Museum's collection, and it wasn't really being pursued widely in contemporary art. And yet, here was this masterful and utterly fascinating masterwork of trickery and tugging at the imagination in ways that once you went out of the galleries where your work was shown and into other galleries at the Whitney, it was a totally different experience. When did you start to show commercially?
Let's see, what year? That was probably in mid-70s.
It's about the same time.
Yeah. Betty Asher, who some of you would have known, was working at LACMA, I believe, at the time.
Yes, she was a curatorial assistant and a research assistant.
And Betty had left the museum and decided to start a little gallery. And she had asked me if she could represent me. And I was, you bet, I'd love to have you represent my work. And we had started a long relationship that went on until Betty retired. And at that point, I went to Peter Gould at L.A. Louvre. And I've been there ever since.
And L.A. Louvre has been particularly supportive of you.
Absolutely.
Not just by having exhibitions, but they've been very encouraging of just the kind of phantasmagoric art that you're creating.
Yes, they seem to trust me, which is counts a lot in my book. And sometimes the ideas get stuck or they go down false paths and I have to abandon a whole bunch of work and they wait. And eventually something comes out that's worth waiting for, hopefully.
As long as we're talking about the creative process, when you look at this piece, Inner City, every square millimeter is carefully thought out, carefully, meticulously, painstakingly wrought to look like something that it isn't. It's not a real building. This is not really distressed wood. It is some kind of material that you've now, with your alchemy and your artisanship, you've been able to camouflage or masquerade as something else. It seems like that would entail a great deal of planning, of prefiguring what the piece was going to look like. How much of your creative process is planning, and how much of it is spontaneous and accidental?
Both. Yeah, I start out with usually a story I'll tell myself. I try to describe it literally by writing a paragraph, a description of what I imagine I would want to experience if I walked into a space and didn't. I mean, I say, Michael, amaze yourself. What do you want to see?
Yeah.
That's how I work, literally. And I try to come up with something that will hold my interest long enough to get the idea developed. And so it starts out with writing at first.
And do you ever show these writings, or is that just for your private? Is that like making little doodles and sketches?
Usually they stay in the archive, like notes and sketches. Sometimes there's a few up in Oakland. But that's kind of how the idea starts. And then it's a matter of ascertaining if it's an institution, you have to find out what the budget is, because it has to be practical. You can design anything you want, but if you can't build it, why bother?
Right.
So a budget is a very helpful tool for the artist, because it allows you to focus your energies realistically within a certain parameter. And then it's a matter of planning out the work, pacing yourself, meeting deadlines. You wear many hats as a practicing artist. You have to. And having said that, it sounds like a very linear process, but it's anything but that, because it's a very circuitous journey from A to Z. There's lots of unexpected changes that are made during the process of creating the experience. Sometimes you have a better idea in the middle of a project and have to change a lot of work. So it's both spontaneous and planned, and they're not contradictory.
No, I can fathom from what you're saying that there is no contradiction.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound entirely tidy either.
No, it's messy as hell. It is. It's my studio is in a constant state of wreckage. It's piles of this and that. And if I don't get on it and clean up from the last show, I stumble over it on the next. So it's a challenge, because I'm not the most organized person in the world either.
What happened after Inner City?
Well, Inner City, let's see, time marches on. This is a piece that's currently in the Oakland show, but it was done in 1987, about 10 years after Inner City. It was done as an homage to my father, who had passed away in 1986. I was asked to do an installation at Cal State Northridge, where I'd gone to undergraduate school. And this idea occurred to me to build a structure in the middle of a body of water that would allow the viewer to walk into this space, and again, to take them out of any semblance of an art gallery and put them in an alien space that was engaging, comforting, and yet strangely other. And to that end, we built a pond in the gallery on a weekend when no one was around. We had a hot tar truck pull up onto the campus. Mm-hmm. The guys came in with buckets of molten tar, walking down the Neutra hallways into the art gallery. This was totally illegal. And we hot mopped a pond in the gallery floor, and then built this thing. And they left, and then Monday morning came around, and there was a pond in the gallery that miraculously had appeared. You couldn't do it nowadays like that. You wouldn't want to do it, because the place reeked of tar for about a day afterwards.
Well, at least a day.
But it didn't leak. So we built this structure, which is all made out of all kinds of detritus, old screens and shutters, parts of cars, all the kind of bricolage, the detritus of stuff that we cast off as a society. But once inside this structure, it's much darker than the picture portrays it. And the way the light is fractured by the water rippling makes this amazing dappled light that moves inside the space and has a very much a mesmerizing quality. That plus the sound of the water hitting the roof and dripping off the sides has an amazingly calming effect. And when it was at Northridge, people would stay out there for hours, literally, in the space, didn't want to leave. And it has that effect. And it's nice to have something like that in this kind of crazy world we're in.
What's your fascination, Michael, with detritus, ruination, decay?
It's unavoidable.
I think there's huge wisdom in what you just said.
It is. My parents divorced when I was a little kid, a baby, in fact, and my father's parents, my grandparents, raised me basically. And so I was raised by 60 and 70 and 80 year old, let's make it 70 and 80 year old parents. And so all of their friends were elderly. And so that was the world I grew up in. Those to me were adults. And my grandfather's library was in the living room of the house, and all the books were about the Civil War. Literally. And so, and he was in the First World War, so my time had been shifted by half a century backwards. So that was kind of the milieu I grew up with. And when they would go to bed at night, this is back in the mid-50s, they had an old Motorola television set that sat prominently in the living room. And the bedroom, their bedroom was in the back of the house. Mine was in the front. So I would very quietly walk into the living room and turn on the TV set at about 9 o'clock at night. And back at that time, local TV programming was in its infancy, and there was a lot of airtime that was not used. And some of the stations, like Channel 9, had a series called Million Dollar Movie. And they would get these films from Europe for, I'm sure, they're dirt cheap prices. And they would run the same movie all week long on the same channel at the same time every night. And that was an amazing, unintended film school for me, because the films were like the New Wave cinema from Italy, a British film after World War II, a French film was shown. I didn't understand this, and I could barely read the subtitles on the fuzzy TV screen, but it took me to another world that was quite unlike the world of my grandparents. And I think that really, I owed a lot to seeing American and foreign film at an early age.
I've known you for more than 30 years. I never heard you tell that.
I haven't told many people that.
Well, it's out now.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to
Yes.
I know you've got some really powerful images coming.
Okay, another shot of the installation at Oakland. Aristotle's Cage from 1983. This is currently in the collection of the Oakland Museum. We walk into a little vestibule and look out what appears to be like a screened window. And we see this beyond it, this kind of desert landscape. In the foreground, there's a trailer out of which we hear strange sounds emanating. And behind it is a junkyard of old cars and oil drums and appliances. And beyond that, the kind of encroaching bits of industry on the horizon. In the sky above, there are these constellation-like skeletal forms of a Homo sapien being chased by a canine. It's called Aristotle's Cage. The title, if I can just digress slightly, the title Aristotle's Cage refers to philosophy and how the idea of Aristotle, obviously the philosopher, cage being a vessel of containment. But in this sense, I'm using the word as cage as a almost like a filter or a thing that holds our vision in a certain specific way. The idea being that philosophy or our belief system, any belief system, really determines how you see reality. It's part of that theme of seeing what you think you see or what you want to see.
So there is a kind of, well, we'll talk about that later.
Sure.
We're running a little late because we got off to a late start and we've been talking at a leisurely pace and we do want to leave time for Q&A.
I'll go faster.
Yes.
Okay. another view of Aristotle's cage. Just incidentally, if you look in the back of the landscape there, what appears to be a series of mountains is actually... I took the profile of the curator, Phil Linares, and then I stretched it out anamorphically and made the landscape. So it's a little conceit.
I thought old curators just went to the tar pits.
This is a work done in the Netherlands in 2006. They had invited about four or five artists to go to the Naturalis Natural History Museum, explore the collection, and then produce art based on that. So for my piece, I selected this skeleton of a South African elephant taken in the Cape in 1840. I had them carefully remove its head and replace the head with that of a New Guinean crocodile. It's about this big, producing a crocodilephant. And then had them raise it on an elevated dais, so we were, in fact, looking up at it even grander. And then I festooned it with these miniature ladders to give a scale to this now extinct beast. And that was the crocodilephant. This piece was done in 92, about the time of that awful siege in Sarajevo and the horrible war over there. This is at Art Center College of Design. The wall is 40 feet wide, 60 feet high. And in the gallery, there's a machine that fires cannonballs across the gallery into the wall at random. If you go out of the gallery, walk around the back side, you can actually go inside the wall, and this is what you see. You can walk down this strange space, there's water flowing through the pipes, and at the very end there's a small desk with a shortwave radio and a sound coming out of it. But as you're walking down there, cannonballs strike the wall, and you literally jump out of your socks.
I'm sure.
That was called siege.
That would make a thunderous sound.
It was deafening. This is Howard's piece.
Not really mine. We'll give it the credit to you and the curatorial credit to Stephanie Barron, senior curator at LACMA.
Okay, but Howard had a lot of... You shepherded it through some tough times.
I'm its adoptive parent.
Yes. But this was installation done in 1982. I believe, or no, 80.
80, I think it was 80.
No, 81.
It was the Museum is Site 16 project.
Yes, 81. Thank 81. You.
81. Is that Carol Elliott?
Anyhow, it was a piece. I wanted to do a portrait of Los Angeles, and I, how do you do that? Well, I thought cars and garages. The garage, the metaphor is the Egyptian tomb that contains the artifacts of the afterlife. And here is retirement is the afterlife, and the tomb is the garage. All those projects waiting to be finished. So I built this space that had this car up on this dais and filled it with all kinds of objects and manners found off the streets of Los Angeles. So here the car is a stand-in for the Faroic funeral barge with these kind of cryptic references around the base of the dias.
This has become a legendary piece, and fortunately, through the efforts of Stephanie Barron, it entered the museum's permanent collection. But when it was up, and it was up for quite a few years, and I'm sure it will return to its museum life again, but in my travels, I would be somewhere in the East Coast at a and I'm introduced to somebody, not necessarily anybody in the art world. And what do you do? Well, I work at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. They have this garage, you know. It's probably the most famous piece, certainly in the modern and contemporary collection. It shares the distinction with the Magritte. This is not a pipe.
Oh.
The tyranny of images. Anyway, let's
moving along, these are all details from that installation. Another work from 1990, Train of Thought. This is also at the Oakland show. We went into a gallery, and this thing ran for 6 months at this location. We see some kind of strange mining operation in the wall of the gallery. We walk up to it, and there's this very fine stream of material falling off the end of the conveyor belt, forming this huge pile. By the end of the show, the pile was twice as high and it engulfed the first three pylons. It was gigantic, like this big. So he said, well, that's interesting. Train of thought, what could that be? Well, if people chose to, they could put their hand out under the falling stream, and what they would see were letters and numbers. It was alphabet soup mix. So it was, I like to think of it as all the literature of every library in the world deconstructed into this pile of material waiting to be reassembled.
Well, I think it's also a kind of interesting metaphor for your art at large. We have in the Roman alphabet 26 letters, and they are the building blocks out of which all literature, all verbal communication, anything that you can say in the form of language can be formed from these 26 elements. And depending upon how you put them together in your belief system, like you were talking about in Aristotle's cave, depending upon how you wish to perceive it, how you determine to edit it or refuse to edit it, that is the very activity of the human mind. It is the imagination at work. And I would go so far as to say, for all of the wild and wacko and wonderful materials that you work with, to my considered reflection on your work over the last, well, for as long as I've known you, but in particular preparing for tonight or thinking about tonight, I would say for all the rigors of your studio practice, I think your real fundamental medium is the human mind itself and the human imagination. We're going to have to suspend our chit-chat up here, but we now invite you to participate in this discussion. And there is, here we have our Vanna White.
Oh. Michael, you are such a storyteller, and Howard was. I'm over here, Howard. Aside from your grandfather's Civil War library, what kind of literature inspires you, or what do you like to read, or what filters into your thinking process from the world of books and literature and writing?
I'm all over the map, literally. I find ideas everywhere. Not to be glib, but I don't have a very precise, consistent reading pattern. I'm very eclectic and jump around a lot. Well, I read history. I like to read. I started college as a science major, and so I have interest in that field. I'm very eclectic. I pick, and something comes out of it eventually.
You have a lot of poet friends. And you didn't show any tonight, but you have a lot of works that have language, words, and some of them almost like manifestos and posters and almost like old pharmaceutical messages and things. What's your relationship, do you feel, to poetry?
I like poetry a lot. I don't write it per se, but I try to make it into I see the films as visual poems. Unlike a traditional narrative film that has a beginning, a middle, and end. I try to make films that have a beginning, a middle, an end, a beginning, a middle, and then the viewer finishes the poetry. It's more like a dream fragment than a linear story. I think the viewer is the most critical part of the artwork because they really finish it. The artist makes it, puts it out there, and then the viewer comes and has an experience with it, however that manifests. So it's really, it's a dialogue mediated by the object.
Sorry. referring to the installation in the Oakland right now, the drawings that you did from a very early period were very fertile. But today, when you're preparing a construction, an assemblage, do you make sketches?
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It just depends on how complex it is, if I need to do that. Sometimes I can see it clearly. Other times I really need to work out their proportions, and I can do that visually if I can see it. I really think with a pencil best. I use a computer for the film work, certainly, but I find I just feel very comfortable with a piece of paper and a pencil as a way of working through ideas. And drawing is certainly a language that I use and feel comfortable using. And I find it's a very good way of communicating. Sometimes I can draw a picture better than I can explain something.
Hi. You mentioned earlier about working in the film industry, but didn't give examples of projects you worked on. Anything really memorable to you that would be interesting for us to hear about?
The first film I worked on was Close Encounters. I was hired to work as a model maker on that film, and then I worked on a series of other films. The last one I worked on was Blade Runner in 83, and at that point I retired. My long-term goal was to be able to make a go of it as an artist, and I'm still hopefully doing that. but the film work was a great experience. It was a great postgraduate education. I worked with some really amazing people. It's an incredible wealth of really smart people that have high school levels in that business. And I was quite happy to be one of the worker Indians as opposed to a chief, because that gave me the autonomousness of my mind. I could go home at night and imagine my own work and not have to worry about the next day's production schedule. So I was quite happy being one of the worker bees. It suited me just fine.
Hi, you mentioned something earlier about kind of the temporary shelf life of installation art, which I thought was really interesting. So my question about this kind of ephemeral media is, do you have the vision, the artistic process, the way it works for you? Does the image of this first occur in your head and then you look for the junk, you use the word detritus, or do you see these pieces and then kind of get an idea from that?
It works both ways. I don't have a very set way of working. Sometimes even seeing like a name in print will trigger a whole series of thoughts that leads to a physical object or an installation. Sometimes I will find a piece of junk or something out in my junk-filled backyard that will lead to something. I find that the having the stuff around me helps me. It's like they're stimuli. And if I can focus on something, usually an idea will grow out of that. But sometimes I'll draw a picture and I'll fully construct something that didn't exist at all before. And I try to make it look that it's had a history already, so that there's an implied narrative in the piece. That's why I don't make shiny new things, because it's a folly anyway, so why not cut to the chase?
Michael, did you remember to patent your spy fly drone?
Thanks, Bruce, for asking that question. That piece that Bruce is referring to is a drawing that was one of the elements in the Traveling Mystery Museum. And it was just a blueprint that I'd made of this highly technical radio-controlled video drone built like a fly. And during the run of the Mystery Museum in Venice, this hippie fellow came into the museum, and he spent an inordinate amount of time staring at the panel. And he came out and said, I want that. And I said, okay, it's $1. I said, he gave me $2, so I gave him 2 prints. And he said something like, now I know these are real. He was actually a very paranoid person. And this kind of, I'm afraid, might have pushed him over the edge, because it provided him proof that he knew that he was being watched, and this was just what he needed. So it happens.
And how long, when did you create that?
1973.
And just, I think, the day before yesterday, 2 days ago, there was a big front page article in either the LA or the New York Times about how drones are getting tinier and tinier and tinier.
It's coming.
you saw it here first.
Michael, I recall that you had early experiences as a kind of a carny on the Santa Monica Pier.
Not directly. That was somebody else. But the pier that you're probably referring to was the old Ocean Park Pier that was there before POP, which is now long gone too. But it was, when I was growing up in Santa Monica in the 50s, it was not the Tony Shishi town is today. It was very much a blue-collar town. Most of my neighbors worked at Douglas Aircraft Company. And in fact, one of my neighbors was a guy named Ken Strickfadden that was the guy that did all these special effects for the original 1932 Universal Picture Frankenstein. So I would hang out in his workshop on my way back from Cub Scout meetings. But the pier, I would go down there to the beach, and my grandmother would warn me, "Don't go under the pier, Michael." I said, "I won't." Of course, I would go under the pier and then up on the pier. And the Ocean Park Pier of the mid-50s was this really, really creaky, decaying, crumbling, creepy joint. It was full of these old arcades and dark rides from probably the 30s and 40s. And they had these clown-like characters outside of some of them that were supposed to be like clowns, and they were anything but funny. They were terrifying in their decay. And that really stayed with me. And then my father took me to Coney Island back in 1957, and that just finished the deal. And I really think that a lot of my interest in installation and immersion of the audience and the experience came from those early, my own immersion in those kind of really edgy, weird places that were totally unlike anything I had ever experienced before.
Michael, do you have much of an image bank that you rely on when you make these pieces?
I take a lot of photographs, a lot. And so I have this big collection of images. Whenever I travel, I shoot footage, or I'll take stills, or both. And I usually draw upon that. And then I've been learning digital compositing and film editing, so that's allowed me to deconstruct my own photographs and build these places that don't even exist, but animate them in ways that they seem credible. Like a lot of these films reference old educational films from the 50s about how to survive, say, a nuclear blast by getting under this chair. You know, all those lies that we were fed come back now as source material of these strange kind of deconstructed little films. So I like photography a lot.
Question. When you reconstruct a piece like for your retrospective in Oakland after decades, how precise a reconstruction is it? Or are you refining it when you put it together again 20 years later?
Yes. And let me say more about that, Carl. The pieces are never the same twice, and that's fine with me. It's the essence that counts. The actual placement, this drives registrars crazy, by the way. But having said that, as long as the spirit of the piece is intact, I'm happy with it. So they don't have to be back on a millimeter basis as long as the experience is intact. That's what counts. No,
in fact, Central Meridian, the piece in Lackmus' collection, was substantially reconfigured from its original. It was a totally different shape, different way that you went in and exited. And during the run of Central Meridian, when it was on exhibition, it would change rather frequently because for whatever reasons, and this was a real phenomenon, that people would bring almost like votive objects and they would place them in the, you know, and we even found a brassiere that somebody left, and calling cards and little personal mementos, sometimes a few coins, and then over the period of a few more days, you would see some of that material rotate out and get replaced by others. It was this ongoing for years and totally spontaneous. It was not encouraged or discouraged by the museum. It just happened independent of the museum. So these things are changing all the time.
Yes. Flux uber alles.
Two or three more questions and then we'll have to say goodnight.
I'm dying to know how you store that piece that we're talking about, that LACMA piece.
Well, I don't have to store that piece.
Yeah. It's their problem. That's our headache.
Okay. Yeah.
A lot of these things are built in modular sections. A lot of them only exist during the time of the museum run. I've got piles of material outside my studio, metal and wood and things like that, and props. The more fragile ones get stored inside my workshop, which makes it really difficult to work in my workshop. So one of the appeals of my recent interest in film is maybe a way of liberating myself from having too much stuff. So that's kind of why I
I'm one of the people who visited the garage many times, and I confess to both leaving and taking things.
Good.
Do you want your brassiere back?
Yeah, so much of your nurturance and so much of what you play with is, for lack of a better word, the analog world. And now that you're playing the digital, can you just elaborate on how you feel it's different, and you know how you think it's taking you to a new place, or are you an analog person who's just finding new ways to do things in digital?
Yes. Yeah, Ted. It's I'm very glad that I was born in the analog age. It gave me access to technology and ways of doing things, methodology that serves me to this day. But having said that, I, as well as I can, as a 65-year-old guy, I'm learning as what I can, what I need to know in the digital age, like the film work and stuff on the computer. It's been a fascinating and a really joyous kind of experience learning a new skill set. I think as an artist, you can't know too much about anything. I mean, it's all there to be utilized for the ideas. And I find that the advent of digital filmmaking has had an amazingly democratizing effect on that medium, and it remains to be seen what's done with it ultimately over the next, like, say, 20, 30, 40 years. I think it will have an impact on the society, no doubt.
Well, I think we can see from tonight's discussion that Michael McMillan is an artist of very restless and roving, nearly boundless creativity and curiosity. a creative figure who is interested in the material world and the imagined world. And I hope you will all join me in thanking this exceptional talent.
Thank you. Thanks, Howard.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.